Strong sunshine, I need goes without saying, and it's the west where we'll see the best of the sun, of the temperatures as well, but right on the east coast it could be rather cool in comparison with recent days, Neil.
All right, many thanks, Helen Willits. Now on BBC Radio 4, time for our Book of the Week. In 1953, Henry Molaison underwent an experimental brain operation, which alleviated his devastating epilepsy, but left him unable to form new long-term memories. Following the procedure, recollections of whatever Henry saw or heard slipped away somewhere between 30 and 60 seconds. In permanent present tense, the neuroscientist Susan Corkin tells Henry's story and what he taught the world about the science of memory. In this episode, Henry surprises everyone when he learns a new skill. Deborah Weston is the reader.
Henry's brain damage was restricted to his medial temporal lobe structures. The remaining areas, except for his cerebellum, still operated normally. These other regions supported several kinds of unconscious learning. In everyday life, he could acquire new skills and remember how to perform them. One skill Henry needed to learn as an older man was how to use a walking frame, which he came to depend on due to his osteoporosis. In 1985, he fractured his right ankle, and in 1986, he had his left hip replaced. During his recovery, the doctors prescribed a walking frame. Once he received this new tool, he had to learn several new procedures. With practice, Henry acquired the technique for walking, transferring his body from a chair to his walker, and returning to the chair. When I asked him why he used a walker, he replied, "So I won't fall down." He had no conscious or declarative knowledge that he had developed osteoporosis, nor did he remember that he'd have several fractures. But Henry did retain the new motor skills from day to day and month to month, a striking example of his ability to obtain and hang on to procedural knowledge. In the lab, formal demonstrations of his motor learning ability echoed these everyday achievements. Henry recruited areas in his brain that were spared, and he could learn and remember without knowing he was doing so. The use of the term memory in this situation underscores the point that we possess more than one kind of memory. We engage our conscious declarative memory processes when we recall what we need to buy at the grocery store, whereas we rely on our unconscious, non-declarative memory when we can still ride a bicycle after not having done so for 10 years. Recognizing that learning can take place without awareness was one of the most significant advances in human memory research. In the 20th century, much of the scientific research on amnesia focused on declarative learning and memory. However, a parallel story unfolded, revealing a different kind of memory by which amnesiac patients could perform new tasks despite the inability to explicitly describe their learning experience. In 1955, when Brenda Milner first evaluated Henry, among the tests she chose was a motor skill learning task, mirror tracing. Over 3 days, Milner asked Henry to trace a 5-pointed star, keeping his pencil inside its borders. This task was challenging because the star, printed on paper, was mounted on a horizontal wooden board hidden from Henry's view by a near-vertical metal barrier that blocked direct vision of the star, his hand, and the pencil. When he reached around the right side of the metal barrier, he could see the star, his right hand, and the pencil in a mirror mounted on the far side of the wooden board. The entire image was reversed. The normal visual cues we use to guide our movements were turned upside down. The task required mastering a new motor skill, allowing this reversed visual image to dictate the movement of his hand. Each time Henry strayed outside the lines and had to return, it was counted as an error. Most people find the task difficult and frustrating at first, but improve over time. And, with practice, they gradually trace around the star with fewer errors. As Henry performed the task over and over again, something remarkable happened. On the first day, his errors dropped steadily from trial to trial, and, unpredictably, he retained what he learned overnight. On the second day, his initial error scores were almost as good as they had been at the end of training the first day, and he continued to trace around the star with fewer and fewer mistakes. On the third day, he performed nearly perfectly. Henry had learned a new skill. This learning, however, had taken place outside his conscious knowledge. On days 2 and 3, he had no memory of having done the task before. Milner vividly remembers the last day of testing. After skillfully tracing the star in the mirror, Henry sat up straight and proudly observed, "Well, this is strange. I thought that would be difficult, but it seems as though I've done it quite well." Milner speculated that motor skills, such as the one Henry had mastered, might be learned by recruiting a different memory circuit, one outside the hippocampal structures Henry lacked. This unforeseen discovery unlocked a treasure trove of learning processes that do not depend on the medial temporal lobe circuits that were damaged during Henry's operation, but instead are mediated by brain areas that were left behind. Henry's mother continued to take care of him for several years after his father's death. But in 1974, when Henry was 48, he and his mother moved in with Lillian Herrick, a registered nurse and relation. In 1977, Mrs. Meliason went to live in a nursing home. Without the ability to recollect where his mother was and why, Henry had trouble adjusting to her absence. He often asked when his mother and father, who had passed away 11 years before, were coming to visit him. That year, one of our lab members noticed that he had written 2 notes to himself, which he kept in his wallet. One saying, "Dad's gone," and the other, "Mum's in nursing home, is in good health." When she died in 1981 at the age of 96, Henry did not take the news too badly. He spoke only of what a nice woman she was and described how she had taken care of him all his life. By then, he had moved into Bickford Health Care Center. When Mrs. Herrick died, his hospital chart listed me as the only interested relative, friend, or contact. So I became Henry's sole keeper, in the sense I felt responsible for his well-being. I watched over him. We might see the 5 decades of Henry's life with amnesia, first with his parents, then with Mrs. Herrick, and finally at Bickford, as extremely impoverished. Although he was always looked after, could amuse himself, and rarely appeared to suffer, what kind of life could he have lived without his memory? Some philosophers, psychologists, and neuroscientists have argued that without memory, we lack identity. Did Henry have a sense of who he was? There is no doubt in my mind that Henry did have a sense of self, even though it was fragmented. Henry knew he had undergone an operation and was aware he had trouble remembering things. Over the years of working with him, we came to know his personality. Henry's kindness was apparent in many routine ways. Socially, he was courteous, friendly, and chivalrous. His behavior was influenced, in part, by the removal of his left and right amygdalae. These almond-shaped structures are critical for processing emotion, motivation, sexuality, and pain responses, particularly feelings of aggression and fear. Was this sweet, tractable man pacified by his operation? From what we know of Henry, he had always been an agreeable, passive person, and his parents made no mention of any personality change after the operation. Still, Henry lacked self-awareness in many basic ways. He was largely unable even to evaluate his own physical state, whether he was sick or well, energetic or tired, hungry or thirsty. In one experiment, we compared Henry's ability to perceive the intensity of his hunger to that of healthy participants, as well as other amnesiac patients. At mealtimes, most of us can assess our hunger, Do we or do we not want to eat? Then, after finishing, we have a conscious sense of fullness. In Henry, we found that his subjective appetite, how hungry am I, and his sense of fullness, how full am I, were both deficient. In 1981, we asked Henry to rate his hunger on a scale from 0, famished, to 100, too full to eat another bite, both before and after his meals. He consistently gave a rating of 50, whether he was about to eat or had just finished. One evening, after he had eaten a full dinner and his tray was whisked away, a kitchen staff member replaced it, without comment, with another tray containing a meal identical to the one he had just finished. Henry ate the second dinner at his usual slow but steady pace until only the salad remained. When we asked him why he had not eaten his salad, he simply said that he was finished. 20 minutes later, we asked him to rate his hunger again. He gave a score of 75, meaning he was conscious of being somewhat full. Only by making doubly sure he was full had we finally brought him up above the rating of 50, but he still fell far short of reporting that he was satiated. We concluded that without his amygdala, Henry did not sense when he was hungry or thirsty and could not engage the brain circuits that told him he had had enough to eat or drink. Fortunately, his overall appreciation of food was not diminished. He told us that he preferred cake to salad, was very fond of French toast, and disliked liver. When people hear about Henry's case, they frequently ask me, what happened when Henry looked in the mirror? If he could not remember anything since his late 20s, how did he adjust to seeing himself as a middle-aged and, eventually, an older gentleman? Once, a nurse asked him, what do you think about how you look? In his characteristic understated humor, Henry answered, I'm not a boy. Being unable to establish new memories, Henry could not construct an autobiography as his life unfolded, and the narrative of his past was also sketchy. For many of us, our personal history is the most critical part of who we are, and we spend considerable time thinking about our past experiences and imagining how our stories will play out in the future. Our sense of self includes the story of our past and where we think we're going. In the short term, we have a plan for what to accomplish today, which friends we will see this week. Henry's operation prevented him from mentally traveling forward in time. In 1992, when I asked him, what do you think you'll do tomorrow? He answered, whatever is beneficial. Cognitive neuroscientists have identified a common brain circuit that's engaged in remembering the past and picturing the future. When we fantasize about our next vacation, we tap into long-term memory for details of past vacations and other knowledge. Remembering these past events and recombining them to create future scenarios requires the retrieval of information from the long-term memory. Constructing the future, like resurrecting the past, requires establishing functional connections between the hippocampus and areas in the frontal cingulate and parietal cortices. Without this network, Henry had no database to consult when asked what he would do the next day, week, or even in the years to come. He could not imagine the future any more than he could remember the past.
At the same time tomorrow, Deborah Weston continues reading Permanent Present Tense by Susan Corkin. The abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. To take us up to the shipping forecast, here's Sailing By.
Thank you.
Now, on BBC Radio 4, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday, the 19th of July. The general synopsis at 1800. High, Marlin, 1029, expected southeast gravity, 1028 by 1800 Friday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north of Sarah. Westerly or northwesterly 4 or 5, occasionally 6 in south. Drizzle and fog patches then fair. Moderate or good, occasionally very poor. South of Sarah, northwesterly 5 or 6, occasionally 7 in east. Drizzle then fair. Moderate or good, occasionally poor. Northeast 40s. Northwesterly 4 or 5, increasing 6 at times, mainly fair, moderate or poor, becoming moderate or good.